There's a little place I know where a bunch of funky people live. They were looking for a sacrifice, one that they had to give to King Kong. Where did he go wrong, King Kong? That's why I wrote this song, King Kong. They took him to a world where it don't belong.
No, it wasn't the airplanes. It was Film Bookcast, the official podcast of filmbook.com, killed the beast. My name is Mike Smith, and joining me, as always, is a man who spent the last 30 years living on a monster-infested island.
Mike DiCruccio.
How you doing today, Mike?
Good, good. It's back to be, it's back to be good. It's good to be back. It's good to be back.
We are off to a great world. Start.
Yeah, this is going to go so well.
Yeah, how was your time on Monster Island? Skull Island and Monster Island are the same.
It was fraught with danger, you know, but I persisted.
That's good. Nevertheless, yeah. He persisted.
I'm going to call out that for a man.
Running away from monsters.
Exactly.
If you've ever listened to Film Bookcast before, first we start with some film news, and then we move on into some discussions where Mike and I each discuss whatever piece of media we've been consuming lately, and then after that, we will move on to our featured review. This week, it is the newest film from director Jordan Vogt Roberts, the latest film to reboot King Kong, and the second entry in what has been dubbed the Monsterverse, Kong Skull Island. Are you excited to talk about Kong, Mike?
Yeah, I think we're going to have a fun time to talk about this whole movie.
Yeah, are you eager to see more entries in the Monsterverse, let's say?
If they're like Kong, yeah, I think,
yeah?
I am.
You're into it? Yeah, obviously. So the first movie in the Monsterverse was 2014's Godzilla. Now there's Kong Skull Island. I think next is going to be Godzilla 2, called Godzilla King of the Monsters. And then I think it's Godzilla versus Kong after that. That's the idea.
Okay.
I don't know what they're doing after that, but we don't really need to know. That's three movies from now. So
yeah.
Although I guess I'm spoiled now because Marvel announces like 9 movies at a time, right? So we know what they're doing through 2050.
Yeah.
So this almost seems quaint in comparison, this Monsterverse.
It's so cute that they're doing it.
Because at the same time, like, what do they have? They don't really have that much to draw from, right? They have Godzilla and they have King Kong.
Yeah, but there's a very long history of both of those characters.
Yeah, absolutely. But like, if you look at the Marvel Universe, like, there are hundreds and hundreds of characters they can potentially build movies off of. And in this Monsterverse, they can do Godzilla and they can do King Kong, and like maybe they can do a Mothra movie.
Oh, I see. As like standalone things.
As like standalone, yeah. Films, yeah.
I see. Yes. No, I agree with what you're saying. I have no idea what else they could use.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see where that goes. But before we get into all of our King Kong discussion, and there will be plenty of that, let's get into some film news.
Hi, it's time for
what?
It's time for some film news here on Film Bookcast, and we begin with something that I think is really, really cool and something that I never thought would ever actually happen. Director Orson Welles is dead, but breaking news, Orson Welles is still
dead.
Yeah,
that's it. That's the film news.
Well, Orson Welles died many years ago, but one of his last films was called The Other Side of the Wind, and it was shot over the course of 1970 through 1976. It was a very long shooting process, and it was never finished. This was going to be his final film, or it was meant to be his final film, or it was going to be anyway before he died anyway. It was going to be his movie, and it never got finished. And there have been attempts to get this movie finished since he died several times over the years. You know, all the footage is there, apparently. They just need to edit it together according to the notes that Welles left behind. Well, it looks like The Other Side of the Wind will finally see the light of day, which is pretty insane. And who else would do it but Netflix?
Yeah,
I feel
of course.
Like every week now, I feel like we're reporting about this crazy thing that Netflix is doing. You know, they're taking on the new Martin Scorsese movie, and they're doing all this other stuff. And now they are actually finishing the final film from one of the great directors of all time. Like, this is insane.
Yeah. Oh, God. Whoa, where'd that come from?
I think you're getting choked up about all this.
I'm just so happy about Orson Welles and his final dream. Yeah, I mean, this is a project I've heard about. I don't know a whole lot about The Other Side of the Wind. But it's exciting that Netflix, our great redeemer, apparently, is going to be finishing it and putting it out. It's big stuff. This is kind of, I feel like this is one of those like Hollywood legend type things about Orson Welles' like The Other Side of the Wind.
Absolutely, yeah. So that's pretty nuts. And I mean, Netflix has so much stuff going on right now in terms of the movies they're coming out with. And I feel like it's almost too much. Like, I feel like at a certain point, yeah. it's almost too much content. You know, I'm eager to watch The Other Side of the Wind. I'm less eager to see it get buried underneath the latest season of Iron Fist.
Right, yeah. I also feel like Amazon is hot on Netflix's heels. I can't remember exactly what just got announced this past week from Netflix. I mean, excuse me, from Amazon. They picked up distribution for something.
Now, I mean, Amazon is also doing a lot of really great stuff. They, you know, they produce Manchester by the Sea, and they produce The Handmaiden. Oh, they I think they just announced The Handmaiden's coming to Prime.
That might
have been what you're thinking about, because that was this past week. But
yeah, it was something. It was something big, and Amazon is moving and shaking, trying to catch up to Netflix.
Yeah. They've been producing a lot of movies. And Amazon, for their part, has actually been more successful in terms of awards recognition than Netflix has, because Amazon will play with the theaters and allow the theaters to show their movies before they're on the streaming service, whereas Netflix wants their movie on the streaming service day of.
Right.
And Netflix has been trying to work with theaters and saying, like, you guys can have it in theaters if we can have it on the same day. And the theaters aren't playing with that, because why would people go to the theater if they can just watch it on Netflix? So it'll be interesting, like we say this all the time, but it's going to be really interesting to see what happens with Netflix in the next couple of years. It's going to be really interesting to see what happens with The Other Side of the Wind. Like, you know, I'm a, like, for film historians, for film geeks, this is like a huge deal. So I'm pretty excited about this. But let's move off that and let's talk about some more silly news. Looks like Sony is trying to still make a Venom movie happen, and they just don't seem to realize it's not going to happen.
Somehow we're going to work in Marvel news.
So they've already set a release date for 2018 for this Venom movie. Obviously, Venom would be a Spider-Man spinoff focusing on the supervillain / anti-hero that was the villain of Spider-Man 3, played by Topher Grace in that movie. No word yet if Topher Grace is coming back. I'm assuming not. this will actually be unrelated to the Marvel Cinematic Universe, apparently, which is interesting because their Spider-Man is part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Yeah.
So I guess it would just be like a standalone Venom thing, which could be cool. You know, there's a lot of room to experiment with this kind of thing. You know, we've just seen stuff like Logan and Legion, like, doing a lot of really interesting stuff with the superhero genre. And so Venom could potentially be like that. And there was a rumor going around that the new movie Life, which is coming out this weekend, is a secret Venom prequel.
Think about that sentence you just said, Mike.
I know. It is not a secret Venom prequel. Because we live in a post-Split world now.
Right.
You know? The ending of Split makes anything can happen. You know, any movie that comes out could secretly be a prequel or a sequel to something else. You know, Alien Covenant could secretly be a prequel to Blade Runner or something, you know?
That one's actually not that far of a stretch.
That's true. I mean, that's got the Ridley Scott connection. That's the thing. With the Split, yeah. I mean, well, spoilers for Split starting right now. I mean, if you haven't heard about this already, then you probably don't care about Split that much. But the reason Split works, Split connects back to M. Night Shyamalan's previous film Unbreakable, and the reason it works is because M. Night Shyamalan made both movies.
Right.
You know, it's not like, you know, Life has nothing to do with Venom. It's not... You know, Life is about a group of people in outer space, and they get attacked by this alien creature, right? That's kind of the idea behind it. And I guess the rumor got started because some eagle-eyed viewer noticed that in the trailer for Life, they actually reuse a shot from Spider-Man 3.
No way. Are you serious?
That's why the rumor got started, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Because if you remember in Spider-Man 3, you know, the symbiote comes out from the sky, like, it comes out from space, and so I guess I don't know exactly what shot it was, but I guess it must have been a shot with the symbiote coming down from space.
That's kind of amazing.
Since Life takes place in space. I gotta understand the life behind the guy who discovered that.
Yeah. Who knows, I want that movie.
Who knows Spider-Man 3 well enough
discover that shot.
Yeah. But so that's interesting. But even like the writers of Life, Rhett Reese and Paul Wernick, who also wrote Deadpool and they wrote Zombieland, they put down the rumor, and they said, no, it's not a Venom prequel. And they were like, people were asking them, like, did you have this with like a Venom prequel in mind? And Rhett Reese was like, are you kidding me? If I could slap Marvel before this, like, the word Marvel before this movie, I absolutely would. But it's not... You know how much more money we would make off of this movie? But it's not a Marvel movie, so we can't do that. It's not a Venom thing.
That's kind of amazing.
Yeah, so it's gonna, either way, it looks like Sony is trying to make Venom happen. And supposedly pretty soon, 2018. So if that is going to happen, we're going to be hearing a lot of news about that pretty soon.
I think that'll be really interesting to see a quote-unquote Spider-Man movie without the being able to use Spider-Man. Like if Sony wants this to not be part of the cinematic universe.
Yeah.
And I get that it's, I mean, I guess I get that, but that means you can't use anything from it, which is Spider-Man now.
I mean,
although they co-own the rights. I don't remember how that worked out.
I think it would be a little tricky. I think it probably still use Tom Holland as Spider-Man, but I think they would not be able to reference any of the
other
outside universe stuff. So I don't really know. It'll be interesting to see what happens there, but I mean, Sony has been just so bad at this for,
yeah, I have no faith that they can do it right.
Like before they co-opted with Marvel to bring Spider-Man into the cinematic universe, you know, they were floundering trying to expand the Amazing Spider-Man into like a cinematic universe by itself.
Right.
You know, they had talked about that Venom movie and they had talked about a Sinister Six movie. Sinister Six was almost going to happen. Drew Goddard was directing that movie.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, that was going to happen. They had talked about an Aunt May prequel to that.
Yes, yeah.
Where she was like a super spy, and it's like, what are you doing?
They were so desperate.
They're just throwing anything at the wall and seeing what's stuck. So I don't put too much faith into this Venom movie, because they've been talking about this since Spider-Man 3 came out. They were saying, oh, a Venom prequel might be in the works, something like that, a spinoff, who knows, whatever. Maybe Topher Grace will be back. That's it.
I'm just excited for the Venom-Rhino team-up.
That's a movie I would watch. If it's Rhino with the Venom symbiote on him.
Oh, shit. That's a game changer.
That is a game changer. I think that'd be really cool. That would be neat.
You're welcome, Sony. I expect a check.
Boom. The Venom Rhino cinematic universe. What we were all craving for. Anyway, last bit of film news, and this is more stuff that I just do not want at all. I mean, the Venom one, I'll see what happens. You know, I'll see. I'll be tentative about it. But this one just seems like a flat-out bad idea. Warner Brothers is trying to make more Matrix movies without the Wachowskis or Keanu Reeves. So fuck that, man.
Yeah, pretty much. Why even bother?
Yeah, apparently, like, when it first came out that this was going to happen, they had the news came out that it was a reboot. It was going to be a reboot of The Matrix, written by Zach Penn, who's a Hollywood screenwriter. He's written on a lot of different things. He's credited as a co-writer on The Avengers, but in actuality, he wrote the original script, and apparently it was terrible, and Joss Whedon rewrote the entire thing.
Joss Whedon things.
Yeah, that's just what I've heard. I don't have his IMDb. I'm sure he's written some good stuff in the past, but he just seems like a very, like, you know, commercial guy, like, oh, you hire Zach Penn. He works with the Hollywood system. And The Matrix is so much a part of the Wachowskis. Like, it's so ingrained in their sensibilities, and it's so, like, I can't even picture what this universe would be like without them involved in some capacity. And, you know, without the Wachowskis, like, so much, like, I don't think you'll find anybody, any single person who is as intelligent and as mindful about the action and what it looks like, but also who has so many different philosophical influences like pouring into this movie. Like, you're just not going to match what the Wachowskis brought to The Matrix. And even if you think the sequels went off the rails, which, yeah, they kind of did, they're still like through and through Wachowski movies. And I would rather have that than some kind of like, you know, studio mandated Matrix sequel.
That's definitely the vibe that I got from hearing about this announcement. Like, The Matrix, the first one at least, or all three of them really, are so unique and original. I mean, they've become this unoriginal thing, like, in retrospect, right?
It's only because everybody copies The Matrix now.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Because The Matrix is so fucking good.
it's so incredible and so unique and original, and to hear that it might get rebooted or have a sequel or a prequel or become this other big studio universe thing is such a destruction of what those movies stand for. And it's rough. It's rough to hear about this.
Yeah, but Zach Penn has since clarified the news and said that it's not exactly a reboot of The Matrix. It's more of a exploration of the universe, which is something I would rather have instead of a reboot, but still, I don't really want it. You know, but even then, there's the Animatrix, which exists, and that was overseen by the Wachowskis, but that's, like, a lot of expanded universe Matrix stories, and, like, so it can be done pretty cool, but again, that was overseen by the Wachowskis. I don't want anybody else to make Matrix. If the Wachowskis woke up tomorrow and decided to make a Matrix movie, I'd be there. I'd be in.
I'm in.
But I just don't see anybody else taking this universe and running with it the way the Wachowskis could. But anyway, he's saying that it's more of an exploration of the universe, and it's the actual rumor floating around now is that it's a young Morpheus movie that the studio is trying to make, and they want Michael B. Jordan to star as young Morpheus.
I mean, like, sure, like, on paper that idea sounds like it could be cool, but, like, I still don't want it.
Yeah,
like,
I mean, here's the thing. Michael B. Jordan's a great actor. He's awesome. Yeah. But, like, he can't make something unwatchable. We've seen Fantastic Four, you know?
True. That's a very good point.
And he's great. He's phenomenal in Creed and Fruitvale Station and stuff like that. And Chronicle, he's great in. But, you know, like a young Morpheus movie, it's kind of like, I feel like sort of how I felt when I first heard about young Han Solo. And I've come around on that movie. I'm excited about that movie now because they've put so much talent behind that movie that, I feel like I can't not be excited for it. You know, Phil and Chris Miller and Donald Glover's playing Lando and all that stuff. But, you know, a young Morpheus movie, I don't even know what that would be. You know, would it just be Morpheus waking up a bunch of different people and thinking they're the one and then watching them die over and over and over again? Because that's what he did before Neo showed up.
Yeah, that's definitely a thing. Like, you hear we get young Han Solo, and without the books, you know, because I don't know what the extent of the universe is or was, because now that stuff doesn't count anymore.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, all we know really about him is that he was a smuggler. Like, we don't know a whole lot about him. But in The Matrix, like, for Morpheus, like you said, we get a pretty decent backstory about references to stuff that he used to be doing. And it was the waking up people. I mean, like, the Oracle said, you're the one. Oh, you're dead. Try again.
Damn. Player two, you're up.
Yeah. Like, what could this movie be? I don't really understand.
And even then, like, I don't think the world's is that interesting to explore before, like, the events of the three movies, because it's a construct, you know, it's a construct of the machines. So there's not much going on there, you know?
Yeah. And it's only interesting because Neo is the one that works. Neo becomes the one.
Yeah.
Like, we don't need to watch the other failures. I don't get it.
Yeah. So, every character in The Matrix is there to serve Neo in some way. Like, Neo is the centerpiece of those movies. And I just, I do not see how this could possibly be a good idea. I don't think this will actually happen. I think it's something that the studio is throwing out there, got some internet reaction and being like, whoop, nope.
Made a mistake.
But at the same time, WB is kind of floundering right now, in the same way that Sony was floundering with the Spider-Man franchise. WB's got the DC universe, which is making money, but everyone hates it. And you know, they have chances to turn that around. They got Wonder Woman coming out this year. They got Justice League coming out this year. Aquaman coming out next year, which just took Avatar 2's spot in the release schedule, because I don't know if you heard, Avatar 2 is not making that 2018 release.
I did hear about that.
So it'll be a full at least 9 years until between Avatar and Avatar 2. Which, you know,
they're just waiting for that cultural relevance to come back.
You know what? That Pandora theme park is opening in a couple months. So we'll see what happens. Maybe that'll, like, spark the imagination again. But anyway, let's get off of Avatar. We're not talking about Avatar.
It doesn't even deserve that much time.
Nor is anybody talking about Avatar at any given time. I actually like Avatar, but it's something that I haven't thought much about in the intervening years since it's been released. But anyway, more Matrix. It would be great if the Wachowskis were involved, but since they're not involved, who gives a shit, you know?
I agree.
Yeah. All right. Should we get into our discussions, Mike?
Let's move on.
All right, let's do that. Let's move on into our discussion starting right now. Watch this. These are my discussions. Just when I thought I said all I could say, my buddy and I talk about movies we see. These are my discussions. There is so much to see, you and me. So we're going to talk about movies for our discussions. All right, let's get into our discussions for Film Bookcast starting right now. Mike, what do you have to discuss with us today?
This week I have one movie to discuss called It Follows.
It Follows.
You're yes.
A little bit late watching It Follows.
A little behind, yeah.
A little behind the times, but you know what? It's a very good movie, and so...
Yeah, I agree. Released theatrically in the U.S. in 2015, written and directed by David Robert Mitchell, and it is... I should have wrote down a star, probably, but oh well.
Megan Monroe is the female lead in the movie.
There we go.
She was also the female lead of The Guest, which you have yet to watch.
I haven't seen
well,
yet either.
But she's great. She's really good.
Yeah, she was awesome in It Follows. It Follows is a very bare bones on its surface horror movie about this thing that follows you. It's in right the title. Who knew?
Yeah. All right. Thanks, everybody.
All right. That's my discussion. Take care. but it is a wonderfully directed horror thriller suspense. There is this impending sense of doom from pretty much the opening shot of the movie. This woman busts out of her front door of her house and runs down the street.
Yeah.
And from then on, we're kind of in that mode, and it's terrifying. They managed to capture so much tension in nothing happening, of people sitting around talking. Just talking about this thing slowly walking towards them is enough to make it scary. And I kind of love that a lot of the acting is young teenagers, at least, or I don't know, late 20s or whatever, or early 20s, because Hollywood. But it's kind of cheesy, schlocky kind of dialogue, and everyone's kind of delivering stuff weird. And it's not in a bad way, because it's very heartfelt. And the movie definitely aligns itself with that genre, because the kids are always up late watching these, like, B-science fiction, Day the Earth Stood Still kind of stuff that you would see on Mystery Science Theater movies on their old black and white TV with the knobs on it. So it's definitely fully in that genre, and it shines. It does a really good job. I had a lot of fun watching it while being incredibly creeped out by all these various naked people walking towards the camera.
Yeah, cool.
So definitely hard recommend. Definitely
nice.
See this movie.
Yeah, I also liked It Follows. It's been a while since I've seen, like, it's probably been almost 2 years since I've watched the movie. But it's a movie that I liked a lot. I'm pretty sure I talked about it on the podcast when I watched it, actually. Oh, it would have been many moons ago. But it's a movie that I liked a lot. It felt very, like, John Carpenter-esque to me, I feel like. I remember when I watched it.
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, It Follows, a very strong horror movie and well worth checking out. And then
it's available on Netflix now.
Oh, is it?
Yes, it is.
Nice. Oh, well, there you go. It's on Netflix now. People should check it out. And then my discussions for today, I have a couple. Here is the first one. It's The Handmaiden. And I finally got to see this. I was so excited. This is the new film from Park Chan-wook, which came out last year. Park Chan-wook, great director, one of the best, I think, working today. He's probably most well-known for directing Old Boy, the original Korean Old Boy. Most recently, he directed Stoker, which was his first English-language movie with Mia Wasikowska. And that movie was incredible. I loved Stoker. I thought it was awesome. It's very Hitchcockian. It's a lot of fun. And anyway, he went back to Korea for The Handmaiden, and as expected, it is very, very good. This came out last year, and it's a lot to take in at times. It centers on a young woman posing as a handmaiden for this rich woman as a scheme to get the rich woman to marry a man she's working with in exchange for cash, and things escalate from there. There are a lot of layers to this story, and it makes the film a little difficult to follow at first. Like, I think, I was in, like, the first... It's divided into three parts, and I was following it just fine for the first part. And then towards the end of the first part... it's almost like it throws so much at you at once. It's, like, chopped up very weirdly, and, like, it's edited very strangely. But if you stick with it, like, more and more gets revealed, and you actually see more of the scenes that you saw before. And it makes for a very rewarding viewing experience, because you're like, oh, shit. I must have had that reaction, like, 10 times, like, throughout The Handmaiden. It's just an incredibly, like, elegantly constructed drama that only somebody like Park Chan-wook could deliver. I mean, and his shooting style, like, he just has this very, like, I think somebody's described it as a maximalist shooting style as opposed to a minimalist.
Oh my God.
Because his camera is just everywhere. It's all over the place. There is just such creativity in what he's doing. A lot of the attention surrounding The Handmaiden is that the two women have, like, this illicit affair together. And the sex scenes between them are very, like, elegantly shot. But there's one just insane shot that's from the point of view of one of their vaginas.
Oh, my God.
It is so weird, but it's such a great shot, too. And it's just a bonkers movie, and it's just a lot of fun. And I really enjoyed The Handmaiden. It's really intense, and it's very long, and it's a lot to take in at points. But if you stick with it, it's a really just incredible drama. And then I also wanted to talk about a couple of other movies I watched. I rewatched the original King Kong. for the first time in years to prepare myself for Kong Skull Island.
Very interesting.
And damn, that is a great movie, that King Kong. I highly recommend King Kong. I don't think enough people have talked about that one.
But, yeah, it's a little known gem.
Yeah, it is a product of its time. You know, there are some uncomfortable moments, racially speaking.
Yeah, super problematic by today's standards.
Yeah, there's one part. There's this one Asian character who is like this overt stereotype, and then there's one part where the like a native person shows up on the ship and kidnaps Fay Wray's character, and the Asian character in his stereotype accent shouts, "There's a black man on the." On the boat. Jesus. And it's like, oh man, there's so much happening here. I can't take it in.
Don't they offer to trade the woman for like cattle or something at one point? I feel like I remember that happening. I don't know.
That's possible. That's possible. Yeah. If you get past that, like there's a lot of great stuff in the movie aside from that. Like the story and the characters are all really solid. And the effects are still like mind blowing today, watching it and like figuring out how they were able to like utilize that, like, the like early green screen technology and early stop motion technology. It's really insane. It's also a lot more violent than I remembered it being. Kong just wrecks everybody in this movie, and it's kind of nuts. I was like looking into it. This movie came out in 1933, which was which means it was pre-code.
I was just gonna ask that. Yeah,
it's a pre-Hays Code movie, and so when the Hays Code came out, you know, for about 30 or so years, there was a very strict rules about what you could show in movies, like in terms of violence, in terms of sex. And King Kong happened before that, before there were regulations and stuff like that. And so, like, I gotta say, like, the body count for King Kong is staggering. It's probably in the hundreds. Like, he destroys a lot of people. He is crushing villagers. There's a part where he's eating people and he's crushing their heads. There's a part when he's in the city and he just like derails a train and like knocks everybody to the ground. And there's just so much stuff going on. He's like punching planes out of the sky. It's it's pretty great. It's a lot of fun to watch. John Wick ain't got nothing on King Kong in terms of body count. And then I also watched Son of Kong for the first time. I actually have all these movies. I have King Kong, Son of Kong, and Mighty Joe Young in a DVD box set that I had when I was probably 12. I'm pretty sure I got it back when Peter Jackson's King Kong came out. And so I got this box set that was released by TCM. And King Kong has all these like great special features. There's like a commentary by Ray Harryhausen, the special effects artist who didn't work on King Kong, but he is, you know, heavily influenced by that movie. And so there's that, and there's a whole bunch of other stuff on there. And Son of Kong has no special features.
It's just there.
It's just the DVD of Son of Kong. But I watched it for the first time, and oof, that one is bad.
It is swing and a miss.
Yeah, really bad. This movie also came out in 1933, the same year as King Kong, because King Kong was such a huge hit when it was released that they were like, we gotta capitalize on this really, really fast. And so this is a very quick follow-up to the original movie released in the same year. And it follows the filmmaker Carl Denham, Robert Armstrong's character from the first movie, as he flees New York in disgrace after the events of the first movie. So he was the guy who's brought King Kong back to New York and like set up the whole show and everything, and caused King Kong to destroy New York. So this follows him, and this movie is 70 minutes long. And the Son of Kong doesn't show up until 45 minutes in.
Oh, so it's Godzilla 2014.
But a lot worse, yeah.
But a lot longer, or shorter, I mean.
A lot shorter, yeah. That's the thing. The effects in this movie are noticeably worse than the original King Kong. And also, Son of Kong is not, like, Son of Kong is not the icon that his father was. he's more of a bumbling baby Kong than the monster of the first movie. They were definitely going for, like, a cute Kong, and he kind of acts as like Carl Denham's protector in the movie, and it's pretty lame. It's pretty lame. He, like, Carl Denham goes back to Skull Island in search of like a hidden treasure that he heard about, and he's there, and you know, he and like this girl that he runs, like, he brought with him, they run into Son of Kong, and Son of Kong saves them from like an earthquake, and then the movie ends, and it's pretty lousy, which is unfortunate. But it was interesting to watch, just to see Son of Kong. You know, it's like,
yeah,
you know, just to see, because I was actually watching the original and being like, man, I wonder what happened to this filmmaker guy after all this went down, because he would have been in a lot of trouble, I assume.
Yeah, presumably.
And so this movie actually answers that question in an unsatisfying way. But anyway, yeah, so that's King Kong and Son of Kong. King Kong, timeless classic. Loved it. Son of Kong, not so much. But interesting to watch if you're into classic Hollywood movies, and like if you're interested in seeing the kind of Hollywood cash grab that still happens today in 1933.
Yeah, it's an interesting archaeological exercise to go watch that movie.
Exactly. But now that we're done talking about King Kong and Son of Kong, should we move on into our most recent Kong, Mike?
We shall.
A Kong of all seasons?
That was great.
Let's do that. Let's get into our featured review of Kong Skull Island.
You knew that thing was out here?
I'm sorry for your man, Colonel. But if you want to make their sacrifice worthwhile, hit us home with proof. Monsters exist.
Whoa. Your friend there can put that down. What the hell is this place?
That's Kong. He's king around here. Kong's pretty good king. Keeps to himself mostly. Well, you don't go into someone's house and start dropping bombs unless you're picking a fight.
Kong's god on the island, but the devils live below us.
And what are they called?
I call them skull crawlers.
Why?
Never said that name out loud before. It sounds stupid now that I say it. Just, you call them whatever you want.
All right, that was from the trailer for Kong Skull Island, the newest film directed by Jordan Vogt Roberts and stars Tom Hiddleston, Brie Larson, Samuel L. Jackson, John Goodman, John C. Reilly, Toby Kebbell, Corey Hawkins, Jing Tian, Shea Whigham, Thomas Mann, and Mark Evan Jackson, among several others. The IMDb plot synopsis of this movie reads, a team of scientists explore an uncharted island in the Pacific, venturing into the domain of the mighty Kong, and must fight to escape a primal Eden. So, Mike, before we get into our review of Kong Skull Island, I thought we could talk about our relationship with the King Kong franchise. Obviously, I just talked about mine a little bit. I love 1933 King Kong, not so much a fan of Son of Kong. And I remember really liking Peter Jackson's 2005 remake when it was released. And that I was 12 when that came out, and I haven't seen it since. And I was actually just looking back at it, and I remember it being long, right? I remember it being a long time. I did not realize how long that movie is. That movie is 3 hours and 7 minutes.
Yeah, it's many, many minutes, Mike. Many minutes.
It, like, blows my mind that that movie was allowed to be that long, you know? And, I mean, it's, like, I know why it happened, because Peter Jackson had so much clout coming out of the Lord of the Rings trilogy. You know, that was a massive success for the studio. Return of the King won 11 Oscars. Like, he could do whatever he wanted, and what he wanted was to remake King Kong, and he took this epic approach to it. And I kind of want to rewatch it, but I don't know if I can sink that much time into it in the near future. But I would like to revisit it at some point. But it's a movie that I remember really liking anyway, even if at the same time, I also remember scenes that I remember thinking could be cut. You know, like there's a scene in that movie where, like, Naomi Watts is ice skating with King Kong, right? Do you remember that?
I don't even remember that.
I swear to God, I mean, I think it happens. I swear to God it happens, or it was some kind of fever dream that I had. But Naomi Watts ice skates with King Kong in that movie. And it's like a very long sequence. And I was thinking to myself, like, this probably doesn't need to happen. This doesn't have to exist.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure I saw King Kong twice in theaters now that I'm thinking about it. And I don't know how I did that.
Wow.
But in any case, I liked that movie quite a bit. And I was also a big fan of 2014's Godzilla, since we're just throwing this out there, directed by Gareth Edwards, which supposedly takes place in the same universe as this movie. What about you? What's your relationship with the King Kong franchise?
Yeah, King Kong is a franchise that I have the same kind of respect for the original, even though you can acknowledge its faults, what we just talked about. I have also seen the 1970-whatever remake with Jeff Bridges and, I lost her name.
I've never seen the 70s remake.
From America, Jessica Lange. It's Jessica Lange.
Jessica Lange, yes. Yeah.
And it's an interesting update. It's kind of like the sleek 70s sexy version of King Kong, which is kind of weird, but it's also the same thing. And then I've also seen the Peter Jackson one, which I just rewatched recently, within the last year or so.
Really?
And I don't remember why. I think I was scanning on past HBO, and I was like, oh, they just got to the island. I'm going to stay and watch and see what happens.
So you skipped like the first hour of the movie.
Well, and then I was going to say, there's 2 more hours. We get to the island, and I was like, oh, it's probably almost over. From then on, it becomes this. It's the precursor to the downside of The Hobbit, where just everything is a CGI green screen, which is fine, but it doesn't look that great. I remember there's the scene when they're running from the Brontosaurus things. Do you remember this? The big stampede down our valley while they're all in it.
I remember a lot of dinosaur action in King Kong 2005.
So there's a part where they're walking down a valley and there's like all these giant Brontosaurus looking guys.
Okay.
With the long necks, and then the raptors show up because it's Jurassic Park. and then the Brontosaurus stampede down the valley, and now all the humans are running away from the raptors and the stampede, trying not to get crushed. And there's a scene where it's Jamie Bell, and the valley starts to collapse under him, and he's literally, you could see he's just running like in place on a green screen, jumping. And it's like the worst shot in the whole movie. Then there's a lot of that kind of stuff going on in that movie. And it's 3 hours and 7 minutes, like you said. It's funny, though, that you bring up that ice skating scene, and I don't remember it. Like, I just saw it within a couple months or a year. I don't remember it happening.
I feel like
it sounds plausible. Like, I remember there's a lot of the movie dedicated to them escaping in New York.
Yeah.
Going on that adventure.
Yeah, I swear, like, I haven't seen the movie in many years, so maybe I have to make that scene up in my mind, but I swear it exists. I'm so positive that if I go back and watch that movie, I will see it. And maybe it's, like, a thing where I will see it and nobody else will. And
yeah. It follows. It's your It Follows.
Yes. I feel like I've mentioned that scene to people, and they have no idea what I'm talking about. And I assume it's because they haven't seen the movie in a long time either, but you just watched it fairly recently. And so now I'm like, what if it doesn't exist, but what if it
does?
Maybe
it's a different cut. It's like the Bernstein Bears. Who knows, Mike?
Maybe.
But so that my relationship to Kong is this kind of this cultural icon, if that makes sense. It's kind of a lot like Godzilla. It's the same type of cultural character. And it was funny, before we started recording, I said, oh, I haven't seen all the other King Kong movies other than the original, the 1970 whatever, and the Peter Jackson one. And you were like, there's only two more.
Yeah, there's only a few. We talked about Son of Kong before. There's two that were in Japan. There was King Kong versus Godzilla, and there was King Kong Escapes. Right. And then there was a sequel to the one from the 70s, which was actually made in the 80s, it was like 10 years later, called King Kong Lives, which had none of the original cast of that. That was supposed to be like a really cheap, like really terrible movie.
So it's interesting that it feels like there's got to be a million King Kong movies, right? Like it's been around forever, and it's so important as a cultural pop culture icon. But it turns out there's only a handful of movies.
Yeah, there's a lot of knockoffs. There's a lot of like different things with the word Kong in the title and stuff like that. But it's really there's not a ton of King Kong movies. Like, you could watch them all in a day if you really set your mind to it. Maybe a day and a half because of Peter Jackson, but
but it's interesting to see that these movies, to see these two cultural icons coming to the forefront again that have been around for. I don't remember when the first Godzilla came out, in the '50s, maybe. I think
Gojira came out in 1954. I think, yeah.
You know, these two things being smashed to the forefront of our pop culture Marvelization, quote unquote. Meanwhile, Godzilla did this kind of thing first.
That's true.
In terms of movies.
That's true. Godzilla, you know, introduced a bunch of monsters in his movies, and those monsters went on to have their own movies in Japan. Like, Mothra had his own movies, and I'm pretty sure Rodan had his own movies and stuff like that.
Yeah, Mechagodzilla.
Mechagodzilla, sure.
Who could forget Mechagodzilla?
Who could forget Mechagodzilla? It's really hard to forget Mechagodzilla because the word Godzilla is right in his name, so it's right there. You're already halfway there.
It tells you everything you need to know, right? The title. But enough about that, Mike. Tell us about Kong. What did you think?
Yeah,
what was your reaction?
Kong Skull Island almost seems like a direct answer to all of the criticisms leveled at the 2014 Godzilla. You remember that movie came out? Like, I really liked 2014's Godzilla. I love that movie. I think it's a really strong blockbuster. But a lot of people had complaints about it. You know, oh, there's not enough Godzilla and stuff like that. The character's really flat and, like, it's not that interesting. And so this almost seems like a direct answer to the criticism that there wasn't enough Godzilla in Godzilla. And I think ultimately that kind of hurts the movie a little bit in my eyes. I think there was a lot of fun to be had with Kong, I'll say that. It's in an action scene, it's really entertaining. Visually, it's pretty strong. And it at least attempts to make a grander statement, you know, I feel like. The movie is set during, like, right after the Vietnam War, just shortly after the Vietnam War ended. And, you know, it's using the soldiers' presence on the island as a metaphor for the Vietnam War and perhaps for some modern wars as well. But I did think the characters in this movie are as flat can be. Like, they're so...
Oh, my God.
They are so boring and so, like, there's nothing there for so many of them. And that's something people said about the 2014 Godzilla. And to an extent, like, I get that. But I think the problem is much worse here. You know, I feel like these characters made so much less of an impression. The only one that really stands out is John C. Reilly, who is great. He's doing great work here. He's great. But like Brie Larson and Tom Hiddleston, they're just kind of there, right? Like
they just look pretty.
Yeah, they're not really having anything to do. Most of the recognizable actors here are able to coast by on charisma, but the script gives them very little to work with. And I suppose you could argue that Kong is the star of this movie. In a way that Godzilla kind of wasn't in his, but I would argue that Godzilla kind of is the star of his, and that there's so much anticipation to see Godzilla in that movie, which makes that movie better. And I guess what I'm saying is this movie shoots its wad with Kong way too early. You know what I mean?
Yes, I do. I think I have a different take. I feel like the issue with Godzilla, so the 2014 Godzilla, is that, you know, the characters are flat. They don't feel that interesting. And we're forced to be with them for so long before we get the payoff of Godzilla to show up in his own movie. What is he in, like 24 minutes or something like that?
Something like 14.
which is fine. Like, I get it. I get that you want to build, you want to make the reveal, you want to, you know, all that stuff. As with Kong, the characters are absolutely, I agree with you, they are fodder for the monsters, and that in like the simplest sense, they are characters. Like, they have names, I assume. but we are allowed to spend so much more time with Kong. We're allowed to spend so much more time with Kong in all of the action and all of the shit going on that them feeling flat or them being flat and being pretty much useless is kind of, I don't want to say forgivable, because it's like they should be characters that I care about. Otherwise them being, you know, exploded or squashed doesn't matter. And it doesn't in this movie by any little bit. The fact that we're with Kong and he's out in the open and we see so much more action involving him and just everything else on the island, allows that to overshadow the characters being useless, because I was having so much fun with the action and with Kong and all that stuff. So I can't explain why for some reason this movie works, whereas every other Michael Bay movie doesn't, like with this kind of thing. Like they do the same thing.
Sure.
And I think it might be because the action in this is so much more open and in the light, and we are seeing fights, we're seeing long big takes, or I mean I don't know if there are long takes, but they're not, you know, there aren't edits that are seven frames in Kong like there are in every Transformers fight.
Right.
Those are my initial thoughts.
Okay, fair. Yeah, I mean, again, I think that like when it's just focused on like monkey action, like it's a fun time,
right?
You know?
Yeah, I'm in.
And there's a lot of that, so I'd say overall I was having fun more often than I was not. But what I meant before with the, you know, I was saying this movie shoots its Kong wad way too early. You know, I really like the opening scene.
I'm sorry, that's just the best phrase. Okay.
I really like the opening scene, you know, where Riley's character, a young Riley's character, and the Japanese pilot crash lands right after World War II, and they see Kong for the first time, right? That's where they see Kong, and we see Kong as well. And we're like kind of taking it back, oh, it's Kong. But I think in retrospect, that kind of hurts the movie later, because how cool would it be if the first time you saw Kong, it was during that helicopter sequence? You know, that...
Okay, yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, if you were as much in the dark about what's going on as the characters are, I feel like that would be more interesting, and, like, you're finding things out along with the characters. I guess what I'm saying is this should have been a remake of Aliens.
Yeah, yes.
With John Goodman and the Paul Reiser role, you know? I mean, like, more movies should be like Aliens in general, but this one specifically.
But specifically. Yeah, I've been thinking about that opening sequence, which is John C. Reilly's character and a Japanese pilot during World War II, both falling out of the crash landing, shooting each other down, landing on the beach, and then they start their battle
Yeah.
But it opens with a shot of the sun and John C. Reilly's character ragdolling towards the island out of the sun. And then later on, when we're in the helicopter scene and it's like the scene that's happening, and yep. Samuel Jackson, they're flying through the hurricane, and he recites the story of Icarus about the man who flew too close to the sun. And Ooh. Then John C. Reilly falls out of the sun in the beginning. And it's, you know, it's pretty clear that, you know, Kong represents the unchecked, unbridled force of nature. And, you know, that's what Skull Island is, the island that escaped civilization or something.
Right. Yeah, I can see that.
And I don't know what they're trying to say, because, like we said, the movie, everything that's not Kong action falls so flat. like that they're trying to make this statement revolving Icarus as man, obviously, you know, by the folly of man. But, right. like, I don't know where you're going with that, Kong Skull Island. Like, I don't think it pays off in any meaningful way.
Just smash him heads and move on, you know?
Yeah, just eat a guy and keep going.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, like, I agree with that. You know, I feel like it is trying to make a grander statement a lot of the time, but it loses track of what it's trying to say a lot of the time, and it's much better at just being about, you know, action-y monster stuff going on. I kind of felt the same way I felt coming out of Jurassic World, I liked that movie more than you did.
That's what I was just going to say. I don't know why this type of thing works for me in Kong Skull Island, where it didn't work in kind of the same thing in Jurassic World.
Yeah. Jurassic World was the same thing, where it's trying to make a grander statement about the type of movie it is, right? That's like trying to take down like these corporate soulless blockbuster machine while also being one. And Kong is trying to make a grander statement about America's involvement in the Vietnam War and about like this force of nature and type stuff, and that's fine. But also, it also just feels like, what's the point? Like, why are we doing this? Just like, and you know, one of the things about this movie is that it wears its influences very much on its sleeve, mostly Apocalypse Now. but it's in the same, like, with 2014's Godzilla, that movie is heavily Jurassic Park and Jaws. Like, that's specifically like what that movie is tied into. And this one is tied into Vietnam War imagery. And it doesn't do much with those influences, I think, other than recreate imagery from Apocalypse Now.
Yeah, but we get like some badass music though.
There's a lot of songs in this movie. There's a lot of like Vietnam War era songs. Often very like obvious picks. I feel like I wouldn't be surprised if it was the same soundtrack coordinator that did Suicide Squad, you know.
I agree. I feel like this plays a little bit better.
Oh, I think for some reason. Yeah, I do think it plays. I mean, it's more era appropriate, and it's like it feels, it's better, and it's mostly just played in the context of the movie. Like a lot of the times, like the soldiers play it over the loudspeakers on the helicopters or something. So yeah. It's not like it's just random songs that are playing in and out.
Except for the guy that, for some reason, has a million 45s with him on this jungle, because he keeps just playing. He keeps changing records on his turntable, and I don't get it.
Oh man, but, we crash landed, but man, I gotta bring my Dire Straits album.
Yeah, thank God I can listen to Creedence all day. but it is fun. Like it is fun. It's exciting, and it totally apes Apocalypse Now. Like
an apes, sure, you said.
Apes, hey, finger guns.
But yeah, they must have cut back to that same silhouette against the red sun shot like five so or six times. Yeah.
I mean, Samuel Jackson's character is obviously Kurtz. Yeah.
Kurtz. Yeah. That's
clearly what that's going for. I did appreciate, though, a surprising amount of references. I mean, Samuel Jackson literally says, "And as always, hold on to your butts." Like,
I was very happy that you got that reference quickly.
I mean, yeah, there's another reference to John C. Reilly's Dr. Stephen Brule, which is weird as fuck. I was not expecting
that. There's a Steve Brule reference? I didn't notice that.
Yeah, the back on his bomber jacket says, "Good for your health" on the back of it. Like, what?
That's funny, because I was joking when the trailer came out and I saw John C. Reilly, I was like, oh, he's playing Steve Brule. And
I mean, he, like, for real though, like, he's got the he takes his cap off and his hair like is sticking out the same way Dr. Brule does.
Yeah,
doesn't make sense. It's a weird reference to make, but I appreciated it.
Yeah, fair enough. But yeah, I did enjoy the hold on to your butts thing though. That was interesting. But I did feel like the movie lost track of its characters a lot of the time too. Like it introduces a lot of characters at the forefront of the movie.
Oh yeah.
And I feel like the movie lost track of a lot of them, or at least I did. There's a Jing Tian's character who is introduced without any fanfare, like 20 minutes in. She's like the assistant to the assistant of John Goodman, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And
the assistant to the regional manager.
Exactly. And so she's in like 20 minutes in. She's like at the briefing scene where they're telling them like, okay, we're going to go to Skull Island. It's going to be great. And then like, you know, they crash land and she's like kind of there for throughout the movie, but she doesn't say much. She doesn't like have much lines. And like, I feel like she just kind of exists. Like she doesn't function, and she survives the end of the movie. She's there at the end. And it's like, well, what? Like, why?
Why? Yeah, it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, well, I was gonna say, there are several scenes in this movie where I felt like characters who should be there were absent, and there were other scenes where characters who shouldn't be there were present. You know, I feel like there were so many scenes where I was like, wait, this character's with them, or this character's not with them? What's happening?
Yeah, I feel like we suffer from the effect of generic white guy, because we're shown the helicopter squadron in the hangar, and we're introduced to, you know, right before we get to Skull Island in the very beginning, where we're kind of sprinting to get to Kong.
Yeah.
You know, we're showing them playing cards in the hangar, and like we see a bunch of people that like are our core like supporting cast of the helicopter people.
Yeah.
And then later on, when the shit hits the fan and there's like bodies flying everywhere, everyone looks the same. And like, I don't know, like we're introduced to only five or six people in this thing. Yet somehow there are seemingly 100 soldiers that we can afford to kill that are not our people. Like, I don't know where all
these people
come from. There
was way too many people like that we had to follow. And I was thinking about that like while I was watching the movie. I was like, man, like if they were down to like six or seven people, I would be into this because they would be forced to develop some of them.
That's the issue, I think.
And so I was watching it and being like, Thomas Mann's character, who's the guy with the red bandana. He seemed like he would have been a fun person to follow. And he had a couple of decent lines. He like had a couple of things playing off of John C. Reilly. He could have been like Bill Paxton in Aliens, you know, like
he almost has an arc. He's so close.
Yeah. And like, I felt like, again, I'm going to compare it to Aliens, because I feel like it's a very similar situation where it's like a group of soldiers fighting off against this unstoppable force. You know, it's, I feel like if you had like Aliens only has like six or seven people, that are getting mutilated at the end. Like, most of the people die off very quickly at the beginning, much like in this movie. And then there's, you know, there's only like a small group left. And I feel like that should have probably been what this movie did. You know, have a small group, have like Brie Larson, Tom Hiddleston, John Goodman, Samuel L. Jackson, and like a couple other like red shirts. And, you know, that would have been fine. I would have been totally cool with that. And like, I think there's more stuff you can do there.
Yeah, I think it's fine in the very beginning. I think that is a really bold choice in helicopter. I don't know. I guess this might be spoilers. So maybe we should save. I don't know. Yeah, but a lot of big things happen. Lots of people die right as soon as we get to places, to Skull Island.
To places. You're not even going to say Skull Island. The island.
I was like, come on, it's in the title. As soon as we get to Skull Island, a lot of people die. But then we're kind of with our separate groups, which is okay. I'm fine with multiple survivors, you know, pocket, whatever. Even though I would prefer them all be together so we could, you know, develop people. But then there's moments where, like, there's just people start dying, and it's like it's guys that I haven't seen until the scene they die, and I can't tell. I'm kind of on the fence about it. Like, on one hand, it's big, you know, fun B movie. We're here to see monsters kill people. Okay, sure, yeah, I'm in. But also, like, that death has no impact then, and it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm on the fence about that. But maybe we should get into spoilers, unless you have other general stuff you want to talk about.
We should get into spoilers. I just wanted to point out a bit of trivia that I discovered, that I came upon just by thinking about the movie the other day. Toby Kebbell is in this movie as a Chapman, who's the soldier who is, like, isolated. Like, he's the one who's by himself during the whole Skull Island thing. And Toby Kebbell also does the motion capture for Kong in this movie.
Really?
Yes. Now, Toby Kebbell was also the villain in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. He did the motion capture for the ape in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Opposite Andy Serkis, who did the motion capture.
I did not know that.
Who did the motion capture for Caesar in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. And Andy Serkis did the motion capture for Kong in the 2005 King Kong.
Holy shit. That's kind of awesome.
So both of these actors have played motion capture apes in two separate franchises.
Wow. Good for them.
Man, I was so like proud when I put that together for myself. I was like, my God. But yeah, so that's something they can talk about at the next party that they go to. I'm assuming they're listening to this and they'll be like, whoa.
Holy shit, he's right.
What a coincidence.
Yeah, I guess just final thoughts before we get into spoilers. I did have a lot of fun with this movie. I think the action is some of the best monster action, or, you know, big budget kind of this kind of, you know, you could equate Transformers fighting, I guess, to this type of action.
Sure.
You know, Pacific Rim style stuff. I think this is some of the most fun and inventive things. I appreciated seeing Kong do the things he does. I think the CG is pretty beautiful in this one, as far as monsters and all the stuff that's going on. And it does this weird thing where, like I said earlier before we started recording, that it's like Guy Ritchie action. And I don't really know how to describe it, you know, especially it happens with Zack Snyder in 300 too. It's weird that I call it Guy Ritchie, but then my only example is Zack Snyder.
When you say Guy Ritchie, I think of like, oh, the camera's going to zoom out and then zoom back in. And then
it kind of does that a little bit in Kong.
A little bit, yeah.
A little bit, but more so, I guess it's the Zack Snyder thing, specifically in 300, where they'll slow down the action of Leonidas swinging his sword or whatever to recreate a frame from the comic 300.
Yeah.
And it'll kind of pause for half a second, and then we continue the action at full speed. And Kong, in this action, or in this movie, the action does that a couple times. We're able to see Kong doing cool, crazy shit. Tom Hiddleston with his machete and the gas mask. Like, there's a lot of cool stuff happening that the camera is doing very dynamic things, as opposed to just cutting every seven frames and letting us not follow anything.
Right. Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think it's the when it's focused on those action scenes, I think it is a lot of fun. But when it's not focused on those action scenes, and when it's not focused on John C. Reilly, the movie's okay. John C. Reilly is fantastic in this movie. He's so good.
Yeah.
Actually, I did want to shout out to Shea Whigham, who was great in this movie too. He's one of the soldiers who, I mean, I'll talk about his stuff in spoilers, but he's a soldier who made a great impression. He's an actor who I love in a lot of things. Anyway, Kong Skull Island, I mean, I enjoyed it. I had fun time. And, you know, I just feel like there was a lot more this movie could have done to entertain me, and I feel like it didn't do those things. But it is solid. It's a solid time.
Yeah, I also think it's an interesting indicator of the whole year is blockbuster season now. It's March, and this kind of we're getting this kind of big dumb explodey movie.
Yeah, I mean, so far we've already gotten John Wick and Logan and now Kong. And
yeah, yeah. There's going to be these movies year round, I think. No more summer is no longer reserved for summer, this kind of movie.
Summer all year, baby. Hollywood.
That's right.
Hollywood is bringing on global warming by itself.
God damn it.
All right, let's get to spoilers for Kong Skull Island, starting right now. All right, so spoilers for Kong Skull Island, starting right now. So I would say, other than John C. Reilly, the samurai sword gives the best performance in this movie.
Yeah, I agree.
Like that scene where Tom Hiddleston has a samurai sword, he's running through poison gas with a gas mask on, and he's slashing shit left and right. Like, that was cool. That was cool as hell. Like,
that was pretty badass.
That was probably my favorite scene in the movie. Like, that was great.
Yeah. That's definitely, I think, the most exemplary scene of the Guy Ritchie action, quote-unquote, as I'm calling it.
Okay. Yeah, I see what you're saying. It's I mean, you keep calling it Guy Ritchie action, but you keep bringing up Zack Snyder.
in that scene specifically, the camera is doing the zooming in and out thing of him slicing everyone.
Yeah, and it's, like, speeding up and slowing down and all that stuff.
Yeah.
I would say, in terms of actual characters, the second best character came from Shea Whigham, I think, who's always great and who is one of the only soldier characters to really make an impression. You know, he has funny lines, he does badass things. There's like a bit after the helicopter crash lands and he's like eating out of a can, and the guy's like, "What are you doing? You have appetite right now?" And it's like, "Yeah, that was pretty crazy, right?" And he's just like he seems like completely unfazed about like the whole thing, and it's you know, it's entertaining.
I think he has a badass line there too, where he's like, "Eating's for the living," and he just like takes a big mouthful of beans or whatever the fuck it is.
Yeah, that was pretty great. And like he's you know, there's a whole scene where he and his troop with Samuel Jackson, like one of the guys gets like impaled by a giant spider's leg, which is pretty badass. That was pretty great.
Yeah.
And he like figures out how to like cut the legs of the spider and like take it down. Like, it was cool. This character deserved a heroic self-sacrifice death that actually mattered, and not one that was completely meaningless. I was kind of upset about this. I don't know how you reacted to this scene.
I don't know how to feel about this.
So what happens in the movie is that he, you know, they're running away from the giant, like, underground creature. This is towards the end. And they're running away from this giant creature. And Shea Wiggum looks back at it. And everybody's like, well, what are you doing? And he's like, don't worry, you guys go. And he's, like, going to do this, like, badass heroic self-sacrifice death. He, like, pulls the grenade pins. And he's, like, standing there with the grenades. And he's like, I think he's, like, getting ready for the monster to eat him.
To eat him, yeah.
Explode from the inside. And then the monster... just whacks him with his tail, and he goes flying into the, into the side of a cliff and explodes on the cliff. And I get that it's like a funny death, but I don't think that character deserved that kind of funny death. I think he actually deserved something like that was cool and badass.
Yeah.
You know, or something that actually mattered. Something that maybe like maybe if it didn't take down the monster because you want Kong to be able to take down the monster. You know, something that could have hurt the monster in some way. That would have allowed Kong to take down the monster or something. You know, I want something to matter out of that death. And it just felt like, oh, well, that was why'd that happen? That's upsetting.
Yeah, I'm very torn about that because one, it is hilarious when it like that moment of when it of when the monster like it kind of slows down and looks at him and you're like, it's going to happen. And then it spins around and tail whips him and he goes flying. I'm torn because it's funny. But also, he's the only character that like I recognize, like you know what I mean. Like,
in terms of the soldier characters,
out of the soldiers,
I recognize him, and I recognize the guy with the bandana because he has bandana.
Right, bandana guy is there for most of the movie. He's with the quote unquote main cast, so he gets a lot of screen time. but then Shea Wiggum gets he has a lot of the most powerful moments. Like he talks about why he has the AK-47 instead of the M16.
Right.
And he says, like, oh, sometimes the enemy's not there till you're looking for one. And, like, he kind of adds – he's the one that – his character is given the opportunity to, like, try to make the larger point of the movie.
Yeah, and that was actually one of the best lines in the movie, which he's talking about the AK-47 and, like, how he took this AK-47 off of this guy that he saw in Vietnam. And John Goodman says to him, like, oh, what happens when that guy starts knocking on your door? And Shea Wiggum goes, I'll still have his gun.
Yeah, like he's given the most out of all the soldiers. It seems he's given the most characterization and arc.
Yeah.
So for him to die in such a horrific, like I heard it compared to the secretary or personal assistant death in Jurassic World.
Right, and I've talked about that death before and how terrible that death scene is in Jurassic World.
Yeah, yeah.
And I actually was reminded of that scene in this movie, but it wasn't during Shea Wiggum's big heroic sacrifice. It was during the scene where John Ortiz is on a boat. And like a giant like pterodactyl swoops down and just like randomly just grabs him from the boat. And then you see like a silhouette against the sun of like him being like carried by pterodactyls and one of them like chops through his arm really quick. And that kind of reminded me of that personal assistant's death in Jurassic World, maybe just because it involved pterodactyls. And I, for some reason that death worked for me a lot better. Cause I just thought it was like, it showed like the randomness of this world and how like anything could kill you at any moment, that kind of thing. And like,
yeah,
you know, I thought that was pretty good. And like the shot of him silhouetted against the sun with the pterodactyls, like carrying him and then chopping through his arm was really effective. I thought,
yeah, I think the reaction right after that is just like, well, nothing we can do, move on. And like, like everyone just kind of shrugs.
Yeah.
But back to the Shea Wiggum's death, I was just going to say, I'm torn between those two things, but also it shows the character, the monsters are smart. I think this is the smartest King Kong Kong we've ever seen in terms of as a character.
I don't know. The other King Kong knew to ice skate.
That's true. If that actually happened, King Kong ice skate. But also we're shown how resourceful he can be. And to have the monsters also be smart enough to realize that maybe this guy, like, that he's trying to sacrifice. Like, that's how I interpreted it, that he recognized what Shea Wiggum was trying to do, so he just knocks him away instead of eating him.
Right.
But I don't know, I kind of like that aspect about Kong, especially how smart he is in these fight scenes and stuff.
Yeah.
Which we can get into later.
Yeah, I mean, I think this movie does try to have it both ways in terms of their Kong, you know, because Kong in the original movie is the villain. You know, he's the bad guy in King Kong 1933. And, like, he's a misunderstood bad guy, sure. He was brought to New York because of humans, and it's because of humans' hubris that he is even there in the first place. But at the end of the day, he's a giant monster killing people.
Yeah, it's also part of the problematic stuff, I think, of the original Kong. But
what do you mean?
I think Kong is a stand-in for like the savagery of native black people in the 1931.
Okay. Yeah, I've heard that interpretation before.
Which is why he is immediately falls in love with the blonde white woman, and it plays into all of those, you know, the savage stereotype.
Yeah. If you pretend it's just about a monkey, though, it's...
True. Yeah, but then my English degree is useless, Mike. It can't just be what it is.
That's fair. Although even Quentin Tarantino even commented on that aspect of King Kong in Inglourious Bastards. When they're doing the whole the card scene.
Oh, right, yes.
They keep talking about... the guy has King Kong on his forehead. This isn't talking about Skull Island at all. But the guy in Inglourious Basterds has the words King Kong on his forehead, and he's trying to guess what character he is. And he's saying, like, was I brought to America in chains? Was I brought to this? And his guess is, am I the story of the American Negro? And they're like, no. I was like, oh, then I must be King Kong. And everybody's right. Like, oh, well.
Yeah, see?
Good job. So you're right. You and Quentin Tarantino, you're on something there.
Yeah, we're on the same page.
But I don't even remember what I was trying to say.
Well, the point I had made, and I think you were kind of commenting on, is that the Kong in this one is not that. He's not the villain. He's not the mindless monkey trying to eat everything.
Right. Well, that's the thing, because I feel like in other interpretations of Kong, there have been like heroic versions of Kong. I feel like in Peter Jackson's version, it's a very sympathetic Kong that you get from there, and like he's sort of meant to be like. A hero, like he protects them on Skull Island, right? I'm pretty sure he does. I haven't seen the movie.
Sounds familiar. Yeah, he does.
And I feel like the King Kong set in the 70s version, like it's more a sympathetic version of Kong too. A lot of times he's portrayed as like an anti-hero. And in this movie, I feel like it tries to have it both ways. Where like at first he's the villain, but then later on he's shown that he is the hero kind of thing. So you kind of get both sides of what people want from Kong. And I feel like if they had just stuck to one thing about Kong, might have worked for me a little bit better.
Yeah. But, I think there's the typical Kong in the original or maybe not the original, but in the 70s one and the Peter Jackson one, definitely he's the villain until he falls in love with the white woman, and then it becomes a protector thing. But it's interesting that it seems like they're going to not use that, right? That he's the protector of humanity and he guards the tribe on the island from the bigger monsters.
Right.
But then they shoehorn the scene where like Brie Larson like touches his nose and then like they're like then he like has a connection with her, which doesn't make any sense for the rest of the movie. Although that scene it feels like that scene happened just to do him rising out of the mist, which like was really cool.
Yeah, it was neat.
But like it doesn't serve any purpose and doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, but the larger allegory this movie's trying to do is the way the soldiers come into the land that they don't know and start just dropping bombs. It's meant to mirror America's involvement in Vietnam. And I feel like Jordan Vogt Roberts, the director of this movie, probably just heard the word Viet Cong once and being like, "That's it."
Write that movie. That's amazing. Oh my god.
I think there's effective stuff there. Like I think there's interesting stuff there. Like obviously we talked about Samuel L. Jackson and how his progression I think is also meant to mirror that kind of growing insanity, and it's supposed to kind of mirror Colonel Kurtz in Apocalypse Now. There's a really good exchange with John C. Reilly's character, where John C. Reilly asks, I think it's Bandana Guy. I was calling that. John C. Reilly asks him, like, John C. Reilly crash landed there during World War II, and he says to them, "Hey, did we win the war?" And the bandana guy says, "Which one?" And Reilly says, "Yeah, that makes sense."
Like, yeah. John C. Reilly is the only character with a full arc, at least.
Yes, and the movie ends on John C. Reilly as well. Like, it ends with an old timey film strip of a soldier returning to war and John C. Reilly, or returning from war, and John C. Reilly seeing his family for the first time in 30 years. And I thought that was a nice moment to end the movie on. I thought that was cool. I'm curious who was filming him, but
right, doesn't make sense. I appreciate he got his hot dog and beer to watch the Cubs.
It was fun.
It's a nice touch. It feels really weird because the final shot of the movie before that, I thought I couldn't figure out what it's trying to imply. Like, it's them on the boat heading towards
it's Kong doing his roar thing. Is that what you're talking about?
I think so. Yeah. Well, so it's them on the boat. Maybe I have it mixed up. Heading towards the refueling supply or whatever. I can't think of the right word.
Yeah.
And we see the helicopters coming out of the storm towards them, and then Kong does his roar, and like we see the reflection of the helicopters in his eyes, I think, and then the movie ends, and then we have that 8mm roll. But like that, it seems kind of like we're gonna attack the helicopters again. Like the way it ends.
I didn't get that from that. I think he was. I think that was just like. I think that was the movie just wanted to end on a cool shot of Colin roaring and doing like his little chest bumping thing. I did want to say the best set piece in this movie. We talked a little bit about it, but the samurai sword thing is part of a greater set piece, which is when they all go to the elephant graveyard from The Lion King, and.
Yeah.
You know, like it's tense. There's cool shit happening. You got the samurai sword with John C. Reilly and Tom Hiddleston both using that, and it's pretty cool. There's a gun turret on top of a Triceratops skull, and it's like, it's neat.
Okay, that's actually the scene, yeah, that I wanted to talk about where we were talking about, you know, how so many of these people are just fodder. So we're in that scene, and he's like, set up the 50 cal! And it looks awesome when he sets it up between the horns of a Triceratops on the skull. Yeah. But it's a guy we've literally had never seen before.
Oh, yeah,
Who sets up that gun?
Yeah.
And it's like, you're not one of the six people we've seen, so like, sure, we know you're going to die. And it's cool, like, it looks awesome how he dies, how he just gets, like, backhanded off this thing and he goes flying. But it feels so weird that it's like, you're a stranger, where'd you come from? Like, like you're a guy, like, there's only six people we've seen so far, and you're not one of them. Like,
exactly. Yeah, this movie really doesn't have that much more on its mind than cool shit happening.
Yeah, which I guess is fine, right? Yeah,
like, it's fine. But it seems like it has more to say, though. It's a thing. Like, it seems like
I think that's the issue, yeah.
It has, like, greater stuff happening, like, on the surface, but it just never really says those things, and it never really broadens those horizons. But it does have the cool shit happening, and so it does deliver.
It redeems that.
It does deliver on that front. So I did want to talk about some of the outside universe stuff. There really isn't much in the way of that throughout the movie, except for one scene where John Goodman's talking to Samuel L. Jackson, and John Goodman talks about a monster taking out his ship in the 50s. Right. And it seemed like it came from like underneath the water surface. And I thought he was alluding to Godzilla. That was like my first thought. It was like he was talking about Godzilla. But I guess it could be about any like underwater sea creature. Oh,
that's true. I assumed Godzilla.
That's what I mean. Like I feel like it was probably an allusion to Godzilla. Because, I mean, he even mentioned the 50s, I feel like. Like that was
right
part of it.
Well, it's interesting that right before – so there's the opening shot, you know, the 1944 somewhere in the Pacific. We get that – and then we get to the, you know, the modern time, the era the movie takes place in.
Right.
And the taxi door opens and the first thing we see is a briefcase with the Monarch logo on it.
Right.
I just recently rewatched within the last couple of months the 2014 Godzilla. So I was like, "Oh shit!" That immediately put me in the like, "Oh, we're not even gonna save this connection till the end of the like to the stinger." Like it's just the first shot of the movie.
I feel like I had not watched the 2014 Godzilla probably since 2014, and so I did not remember the name of that company, and so that didn't even like register in my mind.
Yeah, they even reuse a couple they reuse dialogue or lines from that movie. In the opening scene when John Goodman's talking to Richard Jenkins, the senator begging for more funding.
Oh yeah, Richard Jenkins in this movie for some reason.
Yeah, he's on for 5 minutes. But he's begging for more funding for their research. He says he's like throwing pictures on the thing. And the line they reuse is all those nuclear tests in the 50s were trying to kill something. There weren't tests. And that's a straight line from the Godzilla movie. Yeah.
Okay, that sounds familiar, yeah. And then there is the
it's just cool stuff.
Yeah, and then there is the post credits scene in this movie, which you know I felt like I was a little underwhelmed by, but personally, so what happens in the scene is that Brie Larson and Tom Hiddleston are kept in this interrogation room from Monarch, and the assistant to John Goodman and the assistant to the assistant of John Goodman show up. Yep. Show up and they're and you know Tom Hiddleston and Brie Larson are like being kept there and like Tom Hiddleston's like I swear we're not going to tell the Russians and Brie Larson's like I'm going to tell the Russians and it's like what and I'm like what like what are you talking about which I assume she was just being like difficult. But you know and so they come in there and they're shown images of cave drawings of some familiar creatures. We see Godzilla, we see Mothra, we see Rodan, and we see King Ghidorah. Then you cut to black and you hear the classic Godzilla roar.
You practice all that time for that, Mike?
Hours of work, Mike. Hours of work. And like I feel like the scene was like all right, but I had hyped it up in my head so much, like I assumed we were actually going to see the monsters and not just like cave drawings of them.
Yeah.
And so I was a little disappointed on that front. Honestly, they could have just played that roar at the end, and I think I would have been happy.
And we would have got the same effect.
Yeah, that's a great sound effect, and I feel like it's a very iconic one. And as soon as you play it, people will know like that's a Godzilla roar. Oh my god, is this going to cross over with Godzilla? What? I was disappointed Samuel Jackson didn't show up at the end again and recruit King Kong to the Avengers.
Yeah. Get these motherfucking monkeys off my motherfucking island. I thought it was going to do a really weird, interesting, like, Deadpool thing, or I guess, which is a Ferris Bueller thing, with the scene at the end, because it's black and we hear, there's no image, and Tom Hiddleston is like, what are you doing?
I thought you were going to say, is King Kong going to come out in the bathrobe and be like, bathrobe? Guys, like, what are you doing here? The movie's over.
But almost, that's kind of what Tom Hiddleston says. He's like, what are you just sitting there waiting? What are you watching for? Yeah. Like, he's talking through the two-way mirror.
Yeah, he's talking directly to the camera, yeah.
Yeah, but there's no image yet. So he's just talking to the audience saying, what are you waiting for? And I thought there wasn't going to be anything for a second.
I kind of wish that was the case. That would have been great. Or King Kong in a bathroom would have been pretty great.
That would have worked, too, with a Deadpool mask on.
Then the principal from Ferris Bueller's Day Off is just going down the bus stop and walking down the bus. Good stuff. Anyway, so is there any other scenes or anything in Kong Skull Island that you want to talk about, Mike, or do you think we should wrap this up?
I think we talked about this movie a lot. We're good.
I think we talked about this much more than I thought we were going to, actually. Yeah, for all its faults, like it is a relatively fun time. And I still really enjoyed it. Yeah, you seem to enjoy it a lot more than I did, but even I had like a solid, I enjoyed it. I had a fun time. I feel like I've been a little bit spoiled because the past few movies that we reviewed have been really good. You know, we reviewed Logan and we reviewed John Wick 2 and Get Out and a lot of really good stuff. And Kong Skull Island is not really quite on that level, but it's a solid time. You know, it's a fun entertainment breezy time.
Do you want to see King Kong use a boat propeller as a flail? That happens in this movie. This movie's for you.
You know, we haven't even mentioned this. One of my favorite things in the movie was when Kong, like Brie Larson, falls unconscious or whatever, and Kong she starts to drown, and Kong saves her from the water. But the monster that he's fighting is still alive, and he doesn't realize it, and he attacks Kong while he's doing it. And Kong, with Brie Larson still in his hand, shoves his hand down the monster's throat and pulls out all of its insides.
Yeah.
And if he had just done that without Brie Larson in his hand, I would have been like, that was pretty cool. But with Brie Larson in his hand, I was like, wait, what?
I think that is an interesting take on the, like, you know, the classical Kong protecting the woman thing. Because he just, like, effectively he doesn't use her as a weapon, but, like, she's in his hand. And he just rams it into this thing's stomach.
So that was pretty ridiculous. And that was like the big, like final attack of the movie. Like that was the final. Yeah. But anyway, yeah. Kong Skull Island, enjoyable time, enjoyable fluff, you know,
big explodey fun times.
Yeah. I had fun times. You know, it's, it pretty much fails on a character level, but if you just want monster action, it's got you covered in any case.
Yeah.
I don't think it's as good as 2014's Godzilla, which is a movie that I really, really like. Where do you think this falls between this and Godzilla?
I think I had more fun with King Kong or Kong Skull Island.
Yeah.
I liked it more.
Really?
I don't know if it's a better movie. I'd have to rewatch Godzilla again, which, like, that's probably just an excuse for me to rewatch Godzilla. But I feel like because, you know, we get the big action-y, we shoot our Kong wad so early. and for some reason, I'm into it with this movie. We're allowed to revel in the silliness and the big, large scale, crazy 200-foot Kong in this one instead of 40 feet or whatever he is normally. And that I had more fun because we're allowed to be there. We're not saving the reveal of the monster till the last 20 minutes.
Fair enough. I mean, Godzilla appears before the final 20 minutes.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is that movie is so much about the suspense and the anticipation of seeing Godzilla.
Right.
And I really enjoyed that aspect of it, but a lot of people didn't. And so Kong Skull Island is for you, P. people.
They made a movie for us. How nice.
That was nice of them. All right, Mike, where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. And if you like Dungeons & Dragons, my friends and I post our games at youtube.com/geonerd79.
And you can find me online at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog and all my podcasts and stuff at filmbook.com. Thank you so much for listening to Filmbookcast. I'm Mike Smith. That is Mike DeCriscio. If you're listening to this review via our podcast on iTunes, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, and take a moment to give us a review. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, and even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you're emailing about in the title of your email, because we produce just so many different ones. It's hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Join us in 2 weeks for the next film bookcast, where we don't really know what we're reviewing yet. There are actually a lot of choices in the mix, Mike. I'm going to throw them all out at you right now.
Oh, man. Okay.
So Beauty and the Beast, which just came out this weekend. Huge box office success, which is not unexpected. And I've heard solid things about. You know, I would be interested in seeing Beauty and the Beast for sure, and I think that would be a good one to review. There's Life, which I've actually heard is pretty good.
Secret Venom prequel.
The Secret Venom prequel, Life.
The subtitle of the movie.
There's Ghost in the Shell, which I know you're a little uncomfortable with.
Yeah. I'm not sure how to feel about that movie still.
There's some racial politics with the American Ghost in the Shell that are a little uncomfortable. But I don't know. I think if it gets good reviews, I might check it out. I did watch the original Ghost in the Shell this past week or 2 weeks ago, and I thought it was okay. Like, I wasn't crazy about it, but it's such a good concept that I think it could be improved upon. Who knows?
Yeah.
Also, if it's playing near us, maybe Trainspotting 2,
right,
which is out. I know it's in limited release right now, so I don't know when it'll be in wide release or anything like that, but that's a movie that I'm very interested in. You know, I was a big fan of Trainspotting back in the day. I haven't seen it in many years, but I liked it quite a bit back then. I don't remember. I feel like I don't remember enough of it to, like, all the callbacks and stuff are going to go over my head if I see Trainspotting 2.
Yeah, I would definitely need to rewatch Trainspotting before I saw it.
Yeah, but so of those movies, I mean, I guess there's Power Rangers also, but I'm not paying money to see
that. Super definitely not that.
Yeah, I'm not paying money to see Power Rangers. Fuck that. Nah. But of those movies, of those four, I mean, what do you think is probably the likeliest one? I feel like the likeliest one is probably Beauty and the Beast. That's probably what we'll end up doing.
Probably most likely. I kind of do really want to see. Oh man, I don't know if I want to see Life. Every time I see that trailer, I'm like, you fucking ruin the whole movie in the trailer.
Every time I see the trailer for Life, I was like, what's the point of this? There's an alien movie coming out in 2 months.
Yeah, that too. I just super really want to see Alien Covenant.
Yeah, that looks pretty good. Danny McBride's in it, so
yeah, like, you know, it's gonna be good.
I've actually heard Life is pretty good.
Okay,
so there's that as well. Ghost in the Shell, who knows? Trainspotting 2. Interesting stuff. So we got a lot of choices, a lot of options, and I guess we'll have to figure that out as the years dwindle closer. The weeks, I should say.
We're going to review those movies in 2 years. We're going to just skip the next episode of Film Bookcast and then put out episode whatever number next week is in 2 years.
Yeah, in 2 years, we're going to come back and do episode 56 of Film Bookcast.
Yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, those movies are all coming out. We're definitely going to talk about at least one of them. And anyway, we can also check out our next complete works, where we're not confused about what we're reviewing next. So we're going to be talking Nicolas Cage's role in Captain Corelli's Mandolin.
So
that's an exciting. that should be interesting. That's the movie directed by John Madden, of the famous football franchise.
Video game tycoon.
That's great video games. No, John Madden, the director of Shakespeare in Love. This was actually his follow-up film. So that's interesting in that regard, for sure. And there's actually
our long-awaited Complete Works episode.
When we started the Complete Works, we were like, man, I cannot wait to dig into Captain Corelli's mandolin. I can't wait to find out how he gets that mandolin.
And why the Yakuza want it from him.
I think you're making that part up, but I don't know. I haven't seen the movie yet.
I don't know, me either.
See. All right, thank you guys so much for listening. We are out.
Had to find a lady to give to Kong to keep that chunky monkey tame. He fell in love with Naomi Watts' character. I forget her name. Okay, I have to admit I didn't read the script, because I find that it gets in the way of my acting process, which I've carefully honed, and also I don't know how to read. King Kong, pass the grapefruit pile, King Kong.
for King Kong, because you don't belong. All right, this is where the song gets really personal, so listen up. I show up to the set at a quarter to noon, and then I pretend to get a nasty cramp so I can go back to my sweet-ass trailer and take myself a tasty nap. Then the director dude would pound on my door and say, Jack, this has got to stop. But then the next day I had my sweet revenge by urinating in his coffee pot. And I said, I can't call. Where's a massive song? King Kong, he's got it going on. King Kong, Jack Black wrote this song. So do yourself a favor, please clap along. Everybody now, clap with me. But do not sing, the singing's my job. You'll only mess up the song, trust me. One, two, three, King Kong. Open in Hong Kong. King Kong, he listens to Cheech and Chong. King Kong, this is his theme song. He's a crazy old gorilla, and he guarantee a thriller. And won't you see the movie, you'll be feeling pretty groovy. And a ruby, but I want you back.